from Cafe. This is Third Degree. I'm Ellie Honig. Welcome, everybody, to another Friday episode of Third Degree. I'm joined today for, I think, the third time by Kyra Perkins. Kyra, how are you?
Doing good today, Ellie. How are you?
Wonderful to see you. And remind our audience just where you're in school and a little bit about yourself.
Of course. So I'm a 1L at the University of Alabama School of Law in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I'm Birmingham born and raised, and I'm interested in sports and entertainment law.
All right, good. And just for the terminology, law students do 1L, 2L, 3L to refer to the first, second, and third year. So you're in the first of 3 years. Now, this has been a fascinating week in the law because the whole country has really been watching and I think riveted by the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis for the murder of George Floyd. So, Kyra, I want to ask you first off, how are you taking this trial in? How are you experiencing this, both as a young person and a law student, but also as a young Black woman? How are you experiencing this?
Yeah, honestly, Ellie, it's rough. It's emotionally taxing. It's mentally taxing. As somebody who is a law student and wants to work in the legal profession as a career and also as a passion, it's something that I feel that I need to keep up with. But as a Black person, it's just really, really difficult and really traumatic. Really, we're at a point right now where not only myself, but a lot of Black people, we do not have faith that this man will be brought to justice. And I think it's hard. I think that there's certain aspects of generational trauma that have been passed down to the current generation and fear of not only the cops, but just of walking down the street in general. At the end of the day, this man, the most that he did was paid with a counterfeit 20, and we're having to watch his life be put on and his humanity really be questioned at this point. And it's frightening, for lack of a better word. It's emotionally draining, and every day it's something that I kind of have to balance between being a law student and being a Black person.
That's such an interesting perspective. I'm hearing that from a lot of people. I think it's understandable. You know, I completely understand how the trauma of witnessing this is particularly acute for a Black person, a young person like yourself. And, you know, we're even seeing it with the witnesses, right? If you remember the first week of trial, there was a whole succession of witnesses who were out there on the street or in the store, Cup Foods, when this murder happened. And virtually all of them broke down on the stand. And I think that probably reflects the same kind of trauma, of feeling, of sensation that you're feeling as well. I'm interested in this. Do you and your classmates and professors, do you view the process that we've seen so far, the trial itself, as having been sort of fair and legitimate? Or are you seeing things in the trial itself that are causing you to question the system or the fairness of the system?
That's a really interesting question, Ellie. And I would say that as a whole, the trial on its face does seem fair. I think there have been a lot of questions from my classmates, particularly about the jury and how you even get a fair jury in a case like this. But as a whole, I feel that at least in this case, what I've seen the prosecution doing, it seems like they're doing everything that they can to try to prove their case. And so I would say that it is fair in that aspect. But I think that despite the fairness, there's still a lack of hope that justice will be served.
Yeah, one thing that I think has been a good thing and I'm grateful for is this trial has not devolved into a circus. The lawyers, the judges, the witnesses, they're not grandstanding. They're not, it appears to me, they're not playing for the cameras. And that can happen. And if that had happened and we had seen yelling and screaming and showmanship, I think that could undermine just the sense that this is a fair, orderly, methodical process. So I think that's a good thing. I don't think that that's necessarily going to, you know, get us all the way to where we want to be as a country, but I think that's an important thing for the country to see. So as we talk about this trial, you know, you noted the interesting sort of duality that you're dealing with of viewing this as a young Black person, experiencing this firsthand, viscerally, and as a law student. And I don't want you to try to separate those two things. They are not separable. They are both part of you. And as we talk about this, I want to sort of hear the whole of your view and perspectives. Let's talk about some of the things that have played out this week during the trial, because we've sort of moved into what I guess would be phase two of the prosecution's case. The first part was the presentation of the eyewitnesses in the video. And this week we got into the sort of causation and the use of force issues. So tell me what you've thought so far of the trial and any questions that you may have for somebody like me who, look, every trial is unique. Every trial has its own circumstances, but I've tried a lot of cases. I've tried murder cases. Tell me what's on your mind relating to the trial itself.
Really, this case has been very interesting in a number of different ways. I think that this case was more publicized. This trial was more publicized than a lot of previous cases. So we've really gotten a good look into what has happened from start to finish. My first question being, one of the character witnesses or the passenger that was in the car with George Floyd is being called to testify, and he plans on pleading the fifth in regard to his testimony. And you hear this everywhere on all of the kind of legal TV shows, I plead the fifth, I plead the fifth. What does this actually mean? What effect could this have on this case?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a really tricky sort of dance going on here between the parties. The issue resolves around the person who was in the passenger seat with George Floyd when George Floyd first got arrested by the police. Now, it looks to me like the defense wants to call him as a witness. I don't know why. I imagine they want him to testify about what he saw happening in that car, what he saw George Floyd doing before the police came. In opening, the defense said one of their theories is that George Floyd was taking pills, had taken Percocets, and had fallen asleep before the police came. This goes to the defense whole theory that the real cause of death was overdose. This witness then was assigned counsel, and he took the fifth. What does that mean? You know, you always see it in the dramatic thing where someone's on the stand and they're being questioned in front of the jury and they say, I take the fifth, and everyone goes, oh my goodness. It's often a lot less dramatic than that. Any person whose testimony might be used to incriminate them in any way, it can be on a major case, it can be on the most minor of case, it can be a direct admission of guilt, it could be something just sort of tangential to guilt, has the right to invoke the Fifth Amendment. That's what this witness did. Through his lawyer, he said, I'm not testifying because I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right. Now, the judge pushed back a little bit, which also happens sometimes. The judge had some private conferences and some hearings outside of the view of the jury. What the judge is trying to do is figure out, is there a way that this person can be questioned fairly by both sides where they don't go into those things that might incriminate him? So, for example, if his testimony would be, George Floyd, yes, he took two Percocets and I gave them to him, that's the heart of the matter. You can't avoid that, right? There could be theoretically criminal liability for illegal possession or distribution of Percocets. But if the criminal angle of it has nothing to do with the heart of the testimony, if there's a way to frame the testimony, then the judge may allow it to go forward. Usually judges hear a Fifth Amendment invocation, they just say, that's that, he has a Fifth Amendment right, he's not testifying, so be it. So the judge will rule on that soon, and that'll determine whether this witness testifies. How swayed are you as just a non-expert like me, and this whole idea that, well, George Floyd's cause of death, this is really one of the key defense arguments, was an overdose. It was not actually Derek Chauvin's knee on the neck of George Floyd. How plausible or implausible does that strike you just on a gut common sense level?
On a gut common sense level, it seems like, for lack of any other terminology, a lot of hogwash. As just a normal Southern phrase there, I don't feel that it makes sense for you to say, oh, he took a lot of drugs, and so that led to his asphyxiation, because we see the video. If he had that many drugs in his system, I feel like there would be more evidence of that in the video. Maybe he would have collapsed or something like that, but we see him being pinned to the ground. I don't think that that as a defense actually makes sense with the video that we've all seen.
Yeah, I share the same reaction. I think most people do. And I also find it really hard to believe that he just happened to die while this man was on top of him, sort of, you know, crushing his neck. The defense has a little bit to work with here because there's plenty of evidence. The prosecution put it on themselves that he had a significant drug addiction and that he had taken pills that day. We learned that there were pills found, chewed pills found, and a full pill found in the police car where George Floyd was held with his DNA on it. So there's no question he had a significant drug issue. But the conclusion that he overdosed to me is sort of hard to believe. There's also a few inconsistencies here if you think about the defense. If there was any real indicator he was overdosing, those cops can and should have and would have rendered aid, right? Cops deal with overdoses, unfortunately, all the time and increasingly so as these drugs get more and more dangerous. They carry with them, there's been testimony about this thing called Narcan, which is this miracle nasal spray. It's a mist that reverses overdoses in a very high number of cases. I was part of having our cops in New Jersey start carrying that. They would have used that if they believed that he was having an overdose. So I think that's a difficulty for them here, but it's, look, they're going for reasonable doubt. You need one juror to feel reasonable doubt about one issue, and that's what they're going for. Do you feel like one of the common things that's being said, and you said, I think, a version of this earlier, that it's bothering you, and I think it's bothering some people, that the defense is putting George Floyd on trial. Give me your reaction to that. Do you think that's what's happening, and do you think that's fair or unfair?
I absolutely think that that's what's happening, and I think it is unfair and also somewhat irrelevant. A drug addiction is not a death sentence. I think that whether he was on drugs or not, either, like you said a minute ago, either there should have been aid provided, or that just doesn't make logical sense, and he's still, you know, had his knee on his neck for 9 minutes. And I don't think that it's fair for you to bring in all of his drug history and talk about the problems that he had and the problems that he didn't have. Because at the end of the day, he wasn't arrested, to my understanding, for drugs. He was arrested for using a counterfeit $20 bill. And at the end of the day, the amount of force to put him on the ground and have Chauvin's knee on his neck for nothing other than paying with a counterfeit 20 does not make sense, and everything else is irrelevant. I don't think it matters who George Floyd was as a person, whether he was a good person or a bad person. I think at the end of the day, the question is whether this use of force was excessive, whether that use of excessive force led to his death, and nothing else should really come into play there.
So I heard a defense lawyer the other day, an experienced defense lawyer, take issue with this notion that George Floyd is being put on trial here. And essentially what he said, look, the defense is entitled to argue that he overdosed, right? I mean, that's fair play. They're entitled to a defense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the defense lawyer is certainly not going to stand up and say that his client is guilty. The defense lawyer needs to raise a defense. And if an overdose is a legitimate defense, we can argue. I don't think it's particularly persuasive. We talked about that already, but you're allowed to raise it. Then this is how you do it. You show that he has a drug history and he was using drugs that day. So to me, there's a distinction between putting a person on trial and defending your client within the bounds of the Constitution and the law. And what I'm interested to see is how do they approach the issue of George Floyd himself as this trial progresses? Because they haven't come out and said he's a bad person or anything like that. They've actually kept the argument fairly constrained to his drug use. So I want to see if they continue to keep it within the bounds of the rules of evidence, and the constitutional duty that a defense lawyer has as this trial goes forward. But I also understand that it's difficult, and it may backfire in front of the jury if you're saying, really, essentially, George Floyd was the cause of his own death. Forget about the man perched on top of him. So I get that there's a real conflict and tension there. What do you make of that defense lawyer's point that he said, this is a legitimate defense? Whether you think it's persuasive or not is a separate question, but it's a legitimate defense, and they are pursuing that defense. How would you respond to that? Does that change your view, or do you disagree with that?
I recognize, just as a law student, that everyone is definitely entitled to a defense, but I think there's a way to do it, and I'm not sure necessarily if I agree with how the defense is being put on right now. And of course, you know, there's things that we haven't necessarily seen, just because as a student, you know, I have readings, I have classes, there may be things that I have missed. But to me, it seems like while, yes, they are using the drugs as the defense, they're getting a little farther than they should with that. And I'm worried that as the case plays out, it will become more personal and it will kind of persuade the jury to think, oh, well, of course this man did this and did that. I guess I'm worried that it will lead to a jury thinking that because of his past history and how the defense has set him up, the force was necessary, whether or not it caused the death. And I think that we as Black people, is more so what we're used to seeing, is that the character of a person is being put on trial and the jury rules against the character more so than they rule for the defendant.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart way to look at it. And you make a really interesting distinction here. There's the overdose argument, and then there's the use of force argument. And the argument we've heard from the defense along those lines is he was resisting, and so hence what Chauvin did was not excessive. That does not resonate with me at all, because it doesn't really much matter what George Floyd did beforehand. While they were trying, look, he is resisting when they're trying to get him into the cop car. I mean, that's as clear as the video. He's pushing back against them. He doesn't want to go in the cop car. To me, that matters either not at all or barely at all, because what matters is what happens once they have him rear cuffed behind his back, face down on the asphalt. When that 9:29, that 9 minutes and 29 seconds starts, from then on, if I'm the prosecution, I'm standing up in front of the jury and saying, that's where we allege the murder began. All the stuff that precedes it, that predates it, really doesn't matter and shouldn't be used as a justification for any excessive use of force that followed. And I think that part, I don't believe they've played just right. And I think it remains to be seen if they play it just right with respect to the overdose. And you're right, Kyra, I think we need to watch really carefully how the defense expresses this. And do they sort of cross that line between, we're making a defense here, and we're making it personal, and we're trying to cast George Floyd as a villain? They need to watch that, because George Floyd has come across in this trial as a sympathetic human being. The prosecution did a good job of, we keep saying this phrase, humanizing him, but even by calling his girlfriend to testify a little bit about him. There are members of George Floyd's family on the witness list. We'll see if they're permitted to testify. But if you're the prosecution, you want the jury to see this man, as a human being. So that's an interesting dynamic to watch as we go forward. So Kyra, you and I were talking about another interesting courtroom dynamic, which is the fact that there are four police officers charged with the death of George Floyd. There's Derek Chauvin, and then there's what we'll just call the other three. Derek Chauvin, however, is being tried first and alone. The other three will be tried separately as a group in August. So tell me what's on your mind about that particular issue and dynamic.
I think it's interesting, and I would love for you to kind of walk us through how that works, because it seems like this was one event. You know, we've seen the video, they were all there together, but Chauvin's being tried separately, and then the three other officers are being tried together. So how does that happen? Why is it that Chauvin gets his own trial, but the other three officers are being tried together for this same event, as opposed to having all four of them tried together?
This is so interesting. This is next level trial strategy and chessboard playing. So generally speaking, prosecutors want to try as many defendants together as they can. If you have a multiple defendant case, I used to say to judges, if I had charged 18 people and the judge said, how are we going to divide them for trial? I'd say, I'll try them all together. I mean, subject to courtroom space. Generally, why is that? Because first of all, you only have to do one trial. It's a disadvantage for the prosecutor to have to do multiple trials because the same witnesses have to come back again, a lot of the same witnesses. They've already been questioned and cross-examined once. The defense sort of has the book on them already. Also, you want to be able to show the jury the totality of the conduct. It hits so much harder to tell a jury, these five men working together committed this crime, rather than this one guy, sometimes a minor player, was involved in the bigger crime, and the jury's thinking, he was a minor player, where's the big shots, all that kind of stuff. So tactically, you usually want to try everyone together. In this case, the prosecution asked the judge, they said, we want to try all four together. And oddly, the judge initially agreed to that. The judge said, yes, we're going to do them all together. But then the judge changed his mind a few months before trial. And the judge said, well, the reason is COVID, courtroom restrictions and COVID. I got to tell you, I'm a little skeptical of that, because this whole case has happened during COVID. All of the rulings were during COVID. George Floyd was killed during COVID. Although looking at the courtroom now, it's fairly tight. So maybe there was something to that. But I have another sense of what might have happened here. I think it's safe to say that the prosecution's case against Derek Chauvin is stronger and more straightforward than it is against the other three. The other three may well get convicted, but it's a harder thing to do because they're not the main ones with the knee on the neck. That's Derek Chauvin. Forget about what anyone may have intended. I think this may be playing out for the best, because I think the chances of convicting Derek Chauvin alone are higher than the others. And I think, and tell me what you think of this, I think in the public's eye, what happens to Derek Chauvin is much more important than what happens to the other three. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that, definitely. I think he's the one looking dead in the camera in the video. He's kind of, I don't want to say the villain to the story, but for lack of a better word, they're kind of playing him as the villain to the story. And so that, I think, is the main officer that people are concerned with and the main conviction that people want to see.
Yeah, in the prosecution's eyes, he is the main villain. And I think if Derek Chauvin gets convicted, which I still believe is likely. I'm not going to make predictions. I'm not going to put numbers on it, but I think the case has been strong. I think that's important. And I think that means a lot to the country. If you then, 3 months from now, go into the trial of the other defendants, I don't know how that one's going to come out. No outcome there would shock me, from acquittal to conviction to sort of a mixed bag. And I think if Derek Chauvin has already been convicted and is in jail serving a long sentence by then, and then you get a mixed verdict or a bad verdict from the prosecution's point of view on the other three, I think that's a lot more palatable to people who are watching this, to people who, as you said right up front, who are feeling very strongly invested in this process and its outcome. So ultimately, if I'm the prosecutor, I don't hate the way it's playing out. I like being able to sort of focus all of my attention on Chauvin. Let's make this just about Derek Chauvin. You don't have to sort of detour to talk about what the other three officers were doing at any given moment. And also, by the way, think of how complicated that is. It's already complicated enough tracking Chauvin's motions second by second. You have the other officers, they're up, they're down, they're over here, they're by the police car, they're on the sidewalk. So it makes it a more straightforward presentation from my point of view. So I think if I'm the prosecutor, this might be the rare case where I'd be okay with, we call it a severance, with trying the defendants in separate batches. What do you think of that?
That makes a lot of sense, because Chauvin's case will be a lot different in comparison to the other three officers. And I think that it would actually end up confusing the jury to the detriment of everyone who wants to see George Floyd get justice and for Chauvin to actually get a guilty verdict. So I think it makes the most sense just in the spirit of justice and fairness for him to have his own trial.
Yes. And remember, jurors, we're not seeing them on camera, right? Because they're anonymous, but you have to remember they're human beings and they have limited attention span and limited retention span. And it already is complicated enough understanding the sort of minute by minute, second by second of Chauvin. And you mix in the three others, and the theories of liability for the three others are going to be different, and they're going to be a little bit more attenuated. So to me, I think this is working out well. I think the judge's decision, although it raised my eyebrows a little bit when he made it, I think makes a lot more sense now. So Kyra, it's really important and valuable for me to get your perspective. It's really interesting to talk to all of our young law students. Just overall, how prevalent is this in your law school life? How much are you and your friends and classmates talking about this, whether in class or just, I know it's COVID, so you're not exactly, you know, meeting in the cafeteria or anything, but in general, how much focus is there right now in law schools or in your law, in Alabama law school, about this?
One of my professors, one of the things that she does is she starts every class, she tells us interesting things that are happening in the news. So it's definitely something that has been discussed more so amongst my friends than amongst the other law students. A lot of my friends, like myself, are Black, and they feel very invested in this because to us, it's not so much just about George Floyd so much as it's we see ourselves being put on trial right now for a number of different reasons. And so it's definitely something that's prevalent, definitely something that's being discussed. I think my favorite part of, I guess favorite sounds a little too positive, but the best part about it has been the discussion that I've gotten to have with a lot of my friends who are not so legally inclined, and getting to explain to them, well, this is how this actually works, and this is how a trial gets put on, and things like that. One of my friends, he said, well, there's a video, so why is there a trial? And I said, well, everybody can have a trial, you know? And it's been a very interesting time. I think we're seeing, because of the amount of media attention that this case is getting, we're seeing a lot more people who may not have normally been invested in anything legal whatsoever, very, very invested in this trial. And so it's definitely been a discussion that I've had amongst many different friends as well as fellow law students.
That's a great point. One of the silver linings of this, and I think you're right in saying positive things, good things about this, is the level of engagement and investment that I'm seeing from the public. I mean, I see it through my work here at CAFE and CNN. I hear from people, I hear from viewers. People are watching this trial trying to understand our process more than anything I've seen really in a long, long time in terms of our criminal justice process in particular. So I think that's a good thing. I think thus far, I agree with what you said right up front. I think the process has, no pun intended, acquitted itself quite well, has handled itself quite well. And we've had what appears to me to be a fair and robust process so far. So Kyra, thank you for sharing your thoughts on this with me. It's been really interesting to talk to you about this. I know you and your friends and classmates will continue to watch this, as will I, and we'll keep in touch about it. And by the time you're back in 3 weeks, I think we will have a verdict. So I hope we will have a verdict. Timing can be unpredictable, but I do think we will have one by then. So thanks for talking with us today, Kyra. Great to see you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a great discussion. I really appreciate it, Ellie.
Thanks for listening today, everybody. And as always, send us your thoughts, questions, or comments to letters@cafe.com. Third Degree is presented by Cafe Studios. Your host is Ellie Honig. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The audio and music producer is Nat Wiener. And the cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Stanton, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley.